All right, court is back in session. I assume that council already heard the welcoming comments we made earlier, and so we won't repeat any of that. Thank you for the students that can remain, and if anyone else comes in, it's fine. They just come on in. Okay. All right, we'll move on to the next case. It's number 66242, Las Vegas Paving Corporation versus Coleman. This is the time set for the appeal on filed by Las Vegas Paving after the district court granted a motion for a new trial. And do we have Mr. Ulster? Okay. And also Ms. Heidi Perry Stern?
Yes.
All right. How do you go by on your last name?
Stern.
Okay. And who's with you today?
This is Robert Marshall, trial counsel.
Okay. All right. Mr. Marshall, welcome too. Okay. All right, Mr. Ulster, go ahead. Do you want to retain any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to retain 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Go ahead.
Thank you. May it please the court. This was a long trial. It's 30 days, 5 weeks. It's very easy to lose the forest in the trees in a long case like this. But there was really one overriding factual issue in this trial. That is, whether there was ever a Las Vegas Paving vehicle on Oso Blanca. Ever. Certainly at the time of the accident. That was really, above all else, what was at issue in this case. During the trial, substantial and overwhelming evidence was presented that no Las Vegas Paving truck was on Oso Blanca on the day of the accident, or ever.
I want to go to one of the issues raised, and my question is really threefold, and it goes exactly to that with your expert. I'm talking about, so mine's threefold with Brian Jones's testimony, and that is, he may be an arguably competent witness to testify in rebuttal against another accident reconstructionist, Peter Lease, regarding the animation construction. But that said, first of all, did he not exceed the scope of his rebuttal testimony when he opined in rebuttal to a trucking expert, Richie's opinion, regarding GPS and light sequencing, which, by the way, he admits he's not a GPS expert. Did he exceed the scope of rebuttal when he testified to that light sequencing, which was never brought out by Coleman's expert? The second part of the Brian Jones question I have is, or I should say the third part, the light sequencing was never produced during discovery. It appears that Coleman didn't even know about it till opening, so it wasn't in Brian Jones's expert report, not in supplemental discovery. And we just came out with the opinion that was filed right after the briefs in this case, Sanders versus Sears Page, and if you're not aware of it, I'm happy to tell you about it. But basically, you have something that's brought in, which was not produced in discovery, the light sequencing. Your expert testifies in rebuttal, and that exceeds the scope. So it's an undisclosed opinion as well. How do you distinguish that from Sears Page?
Your question has several parts.
Three parts.
And the first goes to the GPS issue.
Competency of your expert. Second, exceeding the scope of rebuttal with the light sequencing, which was never talked about by Coleman. And finally, not produced in discovery.
Okay. The competency would be an issue if any of the plaintiff's experts actually testified to nitty-gritty GPS opinions, or base their opinions on GPS evidence.
But didn't the trucking expert, Richie, talk about all of the GPS, and he's a trucking expert, all of the GPS, and literally whittling it down to a certain point?
Absolutely. He did use GPS evidence to track the routes of every single truck except one, Mr. Schneider's. It was undisputed in this case that there was no GPS evidence on Mr. Schneider's truck. That was because the third-party administrator, or Zonar, the third-party vendor that administered the GPS system for Las Vegas Paving, lost it. Or there was some type of technical glitch. It wasn't there. So when you look at Richie's the trucking expert's testimony and his animation, he's surmising, he's guessing as to why Mr. Schneider's truck veered off the path that had been traveled for 2 weeks.
I understand the basis of his opinion. I'm asking you, how is an accident reconstructionist competent to testify against a trucking expert?
Because the trucking expert offered accident reconstruction evidence.
Was Ritchie's testimony, what you were just saying, produced in discovery, in disclosures?
Ritchie's, as far as I know, there was no issue of non-disclosure with respect to Ritchie. That wasn't an issue at trial. That wasn't an issue in the new trial proceedings. So there was no discovery issue as to Ritchie. But he did not testify as to GPS opinion. He testified as, nor did he testify as to a trucking opinion. He testified that based on this map I'm creating, which was based partially on GPS evidence, this is how Mr. Schneider broke off and arrived on Osa Blanca just in time to cause the accident. The problem is he offered no scientific or technical explanation as to why Mr. Schneider broke off, nor did he offer any scientific or technical explanation as to how he got there just in time to cause the accident. And this was exposed not only through Mr. Emerson's cross-examination, but this was the bulk of Mr. Jones's testimony.
What about the light sequencing?
The light sequencing was one offhand statement that was made towards the end of his testimony. He testified for 45 minutes.
Well, so you'd admit then he exceeded the scope of his, because Coleman never brought up light sequencing. That was something that they never had. So how is that rebuttal if it was never brought up in the plaintiff's case in chief?
It wasn't brought up in the case in chief on issue three, which is related, that there was light sequencing evidence disclosed by one of plaintiff's experts. I believe it was Lice. I believe it was the accident construction expert, did in his report include some light sequencing information. He didn't testify that to trial. In fact, Lice didn't testify during trial at all. But in terms of pure discovery disclosures, there was light cycling evidence in the record. Now, in terms of...
In his report,
it wasn't admitted at trial. So, yes.
It was not admitted at trial.
It was not admitted at trial, so yes.
Well, then how is it not exceeding the scope? I mean, if you're put on as a rebuttal expert and it wasn't presented in their case in chief, how is that rebuttal? Isn't that not exceeding its scope?
He probably did exceed the scope.
All right, so you admit he exceeded scope.
I think I have to, Your Honor. Yes, the light
sequence. What about then the discovery issue? This was nothing he's ever opined to.
I think both create issues in terms of the light sequencing comment.
And how would you distinguish that from Sanders?
I'm not readily familiar with that case, Your Honor, but I think that we have to look at the general principles of new trials and deference to verdicts, and an error in the admission of evidence will not provide grounds for a new trial unless a different result might reasonably have been expected, and that's under Hallmark, and that's under many decisions by the Supreme Court, and it was harmless error to admit the 122nd light statement by Mr. Jones, and here's why. It's a red herring. Again, there were two choices for this jury to make. Number one, Schneider was on Osa Blanca, in which case, this is a big conspiracy. He was there. He caused this accident. Jury rejected that based on the verdict. Option two was you credit Schneider's testimony, you credit the testimony of every other Las Vegas paving employee. They were on southbound Durango at the intersection. They had nothing to do with the accident. They weren't physically in the right spot. They were just doing their job. If you credit that testimony, then the cycling of the light on Durango is factually irrelevant. It's a non sequitur. It's irrelevant to the issue of whether Mr. Schneider, for some reason, broke off the pack and decided to take a small frontage road that he had never taken that would take a lot longer. It makes no sense.
So let me ask you this then. Then what's the role of this? I'm going to call it the overtaking jury instruction, the negligence per se instruction that a bicyclist can't overtake a truck. Why is this even in the case? Because that's a comparative negligence instruction, essentially. Why is that even in the case if you're now saying the whole defense is we weren't even there? Why are we even talking about that instruction?
That's a fair question, and you know, I don't believe that comp negligence was an instruction that was requested by the plaintiffs. I think it was a function of how the evidence played out. There were lots of witnesses, including plaintiffs' own witnesses, who testified that the truck stopped. They didn't see Mr. Coleman stop. The collision occurred at the rear of the truck. There was substantial evidence that Mr. Coleman was attempting to pass on the right. And so the question was there evidence for that instruction? During the settling of instructions, Judge Alf said, you know, there's evidence on both sides. I have to allow this. After the trial,
but
she reversed herself.
She says she had her law clerk go back through all the evidence and said, I was mistaken. Nobody said this. And in fact, when we went through the evidence, you know, there's three eyewitnesses. Chris Soprano says the bicycle's in front of the truck. It reaches the intersection first. Johnny Hammond says the bicycle reaches the intersection before the truck. And the third eyewitness, I forgot her name, but she's in Chris Soprano's car, wasn't clear either way. So what witnesses are you referring to who said the truck got there before the bicycle? Because there has to be some substantial evidence in order for this jury instruction even to be given.
Yep, absolutely.
And the trial judge says, I made a mistake, there was no evidence, and therefore I should not have given this instruction. You're the one saying that's an abuse of discretion. So what's the evidence that the truck reached the intersection first?
Chris Soprano, this is on page 23 of our brief, we quote his testimony. He was asked if the truck stopped. He said, correct. He was asked if the bike stopped, and he confirmed that it was correct, that he didn't see the bike stop. And I believe all the evidence from the police and all the forensic evidence that we might have available shows that the collision occurred at the rear of the truck. So we believe that you could substantially infer from that if you have a truck stopping, if you have a bicyclist not stopping, then he was passing on the right. In fact, even if you look at Peter Lice's animation that's shown, it shows the bicyclist passing on the right, or at least there's enough there to give you a reasonable inference that it happened.
Okay, so let me ask you this question. This is really where all this is heading to, and it's responsive to what you were just saying before I jumped in here. Presumably your response to this is going to be, even if this was an error, it wasn't part of our defense, and therefore it's harmless error. That's what you were talking about right before I asked this question. So my question is, if all this is harmless error, what's this instruction doing in the case, if that's not part of your defense? Because presumably that's what you're going to say. This is harmless error, it wasn't part of the defense. Then why is this here? Why did you even ask for it? I know you weren't the trial counsel, but why did your client even ask for this instruction if you're now going to say, oh, that's harmless error, it wasn't our defense?
Well, I'm not saying it was error to admit that instruction. I think that instruction was proper based on the evidence that was submitted, and that instruction gave enough, instructed the jury that the truck might not have even been negligent if Mr. Coleman was trying to pass. So I don't think that the instruction is not a harmless error argument, Your Honor. It's it was properly admitted, and you know, Judge Alf heard the evidence.
But if it was error, are you now saying that it wouldn't be harmless error?
I don't think that's the phrasing we use in terms of jury instructions. An erroneous instruction, a verdict based on an erroneous instruction, can only be reversed if, upon consideration of the entire proceedings, it shall appear that such error has resulted in a miscarriage of justice. So again, as with evidence admission, you have to step back and look at the big picture and recognize that did this one issue in the context of a month-long trial with all the evidence that was presented cause the outcome of the trial? And there's nothing in the record that indicates it did.
Mr. Ulster, you did say you wanted to save some rebuttal time, and you're going to get some. But I did want to ask you something real fast. You said we should give deference to what the jury decided, and Judge Alf had the same responsibility. Despite that, she found numerous irregularities in the trial, and one we haven't even talked about yet was attorney misconduct. And are any one of these? I mean, there are various portions of what she found in her detailed order that you can attack or say it's not enough, didn't influence the verdict. But what about the attorney misconduct? That seemed like that really bothered her, and that was a primary reason to grant a new trial.
Yeah. And Those are reviewed by this court de novo because it's a, you know, it's a question of law whether there was misconduct. What she found to be misconduct in the transcript is Mr. Emerson's practice of cross-examining witnesses using three or four sentences and looking at the jury. And that issue was pushed by Mr. Emerson. He's been trying cases for 20 years. There's no case law in Nevada that says you can't look at a jury.
But it's not that. It's she told him, don't do it that way. Doesn't the judge have the authority to control the courtroom?
There's certainly a judge has discretion to control her courtroom. Absolutely. But the and he stopped when she asked him to. It came up a couple times, and again, it's a big picture analysis. Did that affect the outcome of the trial? And as a matter of law, it just didn't. When there's nothing in Nevada that prohibits an attorney from looking at the jury.
It also refers to misconduct during the discovery process. Is that something that's relevant on a post-trial motion?
It really isn't, because the misconduct of a party, which is how what she pigeonholed it to under Rule 59, it contemplates misconduct of a party during the trial. This misconduct of a party went to discovery issues, which were tried throughout the case, and which resulted in an adverse inference instruction being given to the jury.
All right, Mr. Olser, you can still have 2 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank
since
you.
We
Thank you.
Asked you a lot of questions. All right.
Hello, Your Honors. Heidi Stern on behalf of Jamar Coleman. In this case, this court is called upon to determine whether the district court properly exercised its own discretion when it looked at a trial that it had conducted and determined that there were several errors, and then determined that a new trial was necessary to ensure fairness. As you all know, this is not a common reaction to a motion for new trial. It is not common for a judge to look at the rulings that she made and determine that actually they were incorrect as a matter of law, and also that they were poisonous. That is the term that she used, that these errors caused poisonous testimony to infect the trial and create an unfair situation.
Ulster brought up what I was going to bring up to you, which is I would ask you to, you know, cite any law that you can or violation of the rules of evidence that says that an attorney can't ask leading questions on cross-examination. That's quintessential cross-examination. And what? How can it be attorney misconduct for the attorney to look at the jury? Wasn't the district court incorrect in its ruling? There's no rules of evidence. There's no NRS that you could cite to this court that says that on cross-examination. I mean, that is cross-examination. How could they have committed attorney misconduct based on what I've just proffered to you? And
I don't disagree with that from an academic standpoint, Your Honor. I would disagree with it from a practical standpoint as to second-guessing what the judge determined, because she was the one who had the obligation, the gatekeeping obligation, to keep prejudice away from the jury. She was the one sitting there. I wasn't there. You weren't there. It could have been completely egregious, and she can't really express that in words.
She clearly didn't express more on the record than cross-examination and looks at the jury.
Yeah, and I would focus...
And violation of her order to stop doing
sure.
it.
Sure, as well. As well.
Where is that?
As an academic matter, sure. As a practical matter, I think things are different when you're sitting there as the judge with that obligation that she had. But I would want to focus this court on the primary prejudice that occurred at trial, the primary errors that occurred. And, of course, that brings us to Brian Jones, the expert for the defendants. First of all, Brian Jones should never have been allowed to testify because he wasn't, at least as an accident reconstructionist, which was his only qualification, because he wasn't testifying in rebuttal to any other expert. And there's simply no law, no cases that can be cited that would allow...
Well, hang on. I think the argument they're making is, even though they didn't actually call Peter Lease or Lice, whatever his name is, to testify, they played his animation. So the argument is, isn't that the functional equivalent of having him testify, even though he's not actually on the stand? Because what he would have testified to was just seen by the jury.
It was actually admitted in evidence in your case in chief.
It was stipulated.
So they agreed. Okay, at the end of the day, stipulated, not stipulated, it's in evidence. Mm-hmm. The jury sees in evidence in your case in chief that accent reconstructionist, that recreation. Certainly
saying,
they can't rebut that. I mean, it doesn't have to be testimony. It was presented as evidence in your case in chief. Certainly they can bring rebuttal evidence, i.e. by way of testimony, to rebut what you've now entered into evidence.
Two things about that. One is I would actually disagree. They did not cite any cases, nor are there any, trust me. There are not any cases in which any court or case law has found that you can have rebuttal testimony against a demonstrative exhibit.
What if they, let me ask you a hypothetical.
It's not demonstrative, it's in evidence. Was that not, it was played for the jury, but didn't it go back to the jury room? That was in evidence. If it went in evidence, that's not demonstrative.
Okay. So
that is evidence.
Forgive my adjective error.
And let me give you a variant. What if they stipulated in evidence's report and he didn't testify? Would you then allow a rebuttal expert to testify in response to the report?
That's a good question. I think that would present a somewhat different situation because what the evidence presented to the animations do is simplify things for the jury. Now, if you had a report, I'm not saying there's any case law on that either. As far as I know, everything is testimony. But if you had a report that was read in or some kind of deposition or testimony that was read in, that would present the nuances of that testimony that then a rebuttal expert could actually oppose. The problem we have here is all of the case law regarding rebuttal testimony that establishes the standards and everything like that for rebuttal is based on this idea of a person and a person. It's based on the idea of a statement and a rebutting statement. With regard to the jury viewing animations...
What law do you have to claim that? That it's just testimony versus testimony?
Well, you can look at the law actually cited in defendant's own brief. All of the case law they cited in this section of their brief is testimony versus testimony, and in fact it characterizes the exhibits that accompanied that testimony as adjunct, as you know, something separate and apart from the testimony. So you know, I would say you could look at those cases, and pretty much every case on you know Williams and Hallmark, every case is testimony.
But if you're not successful on this argument that he should never even testify at all, what's the next point?
Okay.
With Mr. Jones.
So then we move on. And we have a situation in which Jones was not qualified as a GPS expert, okay? So that's undisputed. Yet, he was permitted to testify as a rebuttal expert in this against this GPS mapping animation and the testimony of Ritchie, who is the trucking and GPS expert for the plaintiffs. And I know that the defendants say that GPS mapping animation didn't really involve GPS and it was actually accident reconstruction. But if you look at his expert report, it goes into quite a bit of detail as to what he did to establish that animation. He traveled the route. He looked at the way tickets. He looked at the fueling tickets. He looked, you know, he is familiar with trucking and how the trucks were supposed to go across the valley and things like that. If you look at, it's interesting if you look at the testimony of Brian Jones and you look at his accident reconstruction testimony versus his GPS testimony, his accident reconstruction testimony actually seems to be based in a methodology. He seems to know what he's talking about. When you look at his GPS rebuttal testimony, it's all just, well, that's speculation. Why would they ever travel on Oso Blanca? Well, I would argue that's him speculating himself as to what would happen because he doesn't have the expertise to critique that GPS mapping animation in a scientific way. And so for that reason, he fails the Hallmark test, both because he's not qualified, but also because he's not helpful. He doesn't assist the jury. The jury could come to the same conclusions that he gave themselves as lay people. They knew that there was no GPS data for 413. Defendants made sure they knew that. But what ended up happening, and many courts have recognized that juries tend to overvalue expert testimony. Rightly so. They're told this person is an expert. And so I think that's probably partly where the judge's poisonous comment came from, was she saw after he gave his testimony that he did not have an expertise in this area, and that yet the jury was being told, hey, this guy knows what he's talking about, and he just said, oh, there's no way that this mapping animation can be accurate. So unless the court has any more questions on that, I'd like to address the issue of prejudice. And just encourage the court to apply the correct standard of prejudice. Defendants have tried to change that standard slightly by saying, well, if there was substantial evidence to support the verdict, then you have to uphold the verdict. But that's not the situation here. The situation here is when you have an error, when the court recognizes that there was an error, would the outcome reasonably be expected to be different in the absence of that error? And here, not only do we have one error, we have multiple errors. So we have the error with Brian Jones, and his testimony, in addition to what we've already discussed, ties in other factors of prejudice in this case. He testified regarding light cycling. And I would also point out to the court that not only, you know, the defense can say, well, that was just an offhand comment. The problem is counsel for the defendants also talked about light cycling at length and without context. Okay? So those two things combined to tell the jury, oh, there's no way this accident could have happened this way because of light cycling. And the testimony is incredibly
It appeared that that may have been the crux of the defense argument, was the light cycling.
It was one of the cruxes, yes. That and the missing GPS evidence, I would say, were two cruxes of their testimony. So moving on then to the GPS issue. So you have the light cycling prejudice. You have the Brian Jones testimony prejudice in general, that he shouldn't have been testifying as to GPS mapping. And finally, you have these jury instructions. And, you know, the court basically looking back at the trial and observing it found, wow, they really focused on this missing GPS, yet they were the ones who destroyed it, the defendants, Las Vegas Paving. And in addition to that, as she listened to that testimony come out at trial, and even to the extent that the defense counsel made a motion for a mistrial based on the confusion surrounding that missing GPS, there was just testimony all over the place as to what had happened with that GPS. So she concluded at the end, she couldn't have concluded this before trial, frankly, it would have been hard for her to conclude this. But at the end of trial, she concluded this was willful. Everyone's giving me a different story.
She gave the rebuttable presumption instead of the inference. She heard all the evidence.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think that she, when she had the chance to academically afterwards in calm go back and look at that evidence, I think that affected her decision.
Well, the difference between an adverse inference instruction and a rebuttable presumption instruction is the intent to harm by the party that disposed of the evidence. So even if she theoretically could have given either instruction, in her actual order granting the new trial, she actually crosses out the words with intent to harm. So how is this a proper order now? How can we affirm that when she crossed out the one finding you need?
I would say two things. One is that the overall context of that order and the willfulness, I think, does show intent to harm. I think it's supported in the record, even though she did cross that out. But I would say for the purposes of this court, remanding with instructions would be the way to handle that. I think you can affirm because there's enough in the record, and this court can affirm based on whatever's available in the record. But with instructions to make that
oral findings, she made that intent to harm, mm-hmm. yet she deliberately crosses it out, and then we're in the position we go by the written order.
It is very confusing.
That's the law.
But this court has the ability to affirm based on anything that's supported in the record, and it also has the ability to remand with instructions. So I think there are ways procedurally to deal with that. It is I don't know why that happened, frankly. I cannot explain that. But and so, you know, I would just end by asking this court to give deference to this district court. She had a very difficult decision to make. She sat through a long trial. And as the defense counsel aptly pointed out, while you're sitting there, it's easy to lose yourself in the trees and lose sight of the forest. But once she was able to review what had happened, and after sitting through and putting herself in the position of the jury, watching the jury, listening to counsel, she was able to see how the errors led to prejudice here. She has that discretion. That is her role. And she made the difficult decision to grant a new trial in order to grant fairness to Mr. Coleman. One thing that I would point out before ending, though, is there's this idea in the defendant's brief that because this was such a long trial, Brian Jones's 45 minutes of testimony could not have been that important. And I would just urge this court to view the record as a whole, because he touched on the very heart of plaintiff's case. And his testimony, combined with the comments of defense counsel, touched on the heart of the case, which is, was this a Las Vegas paving truck? How did the Las Vegas paving truck arrive at the scene of the accident? And how did the accident actually happen? And all of the errors that led to him testifying prejudiced those heart of the case issues. In addition, he testified towards the end of the trial. And so function is a bit of a last word for defense. So I would ask this court to affirm and not second-guess the discretion of the district court, unless there are further questions. My time is almost out.
Thank you very much, Ms. Stern.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Olson, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you. This court does not afford discretion, however, to legal error. And in Judge Alf's own words, her new trial ruling was based on 59A7, which is errors of law. So whether we're talking about what is and what is not misconduct, what should or should not have been admitted in terms of an evidence standpoint, these are issues of law which you take a fresh look at de novo. So this is not a deference situation. The only issue, and Judge Tao, as you pointed out, her order is very telling. Whether it be striking out the intent to harm with respect to the party misconduct and rebuttable presumption issue, or any of these other issues, there's only one issue where she specifically held in her new trial order that this made a difference. And I think counsel's correct. She did use the term poisonous with respect to Brian Jones' testimony. But that's the only issue where she said all this stuff, it only made a difference with respect to Brian Jones. And I'll just conclude on with Mr. Jones. We can't fall into the trap of putting form over substance and just looking at labels. Yes, he was labeled a GPS expert. Yes, he was labeled a trucking expert. He didn't rely on GPS evidence to place Mr. Schneider at the scene. He had no explanation as to why he broke off from the caravan. His timing, his scientific timing exercise analysis consisted of driving the route in a passenger car 3 years later in conditions that were totally different. He was asked on the stand, do you know there was construction going on in Osa Blanca at the time of the accident? No. So he drives the route three times, and that's the extent of his scientific analysis. That's not a GPS analysis. That's not a trucking analysis. He was in a passenger car. And all Mr. Jones did for the bulk of his 44 minutes was say, you have no scientific basis for this. The Nevada Supreme Court has recognized that a rebuttal expert can properly testify as to the paucity of information provided by the other side's experts. That is quintessential rebuttal expert testimony. That's all Mr. Jones did. He pointed out the common sense flaws in Mr. Ritchie's testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Olster.
Thank you.
Excellent job by both attorneys. We really appreciate it. It's helpful for the court. As you can see, we had a lot of questions. There were a lot of issues, and this made a difference. So thank you. All right, so this matter will be submitted to the court for a decision at a later time, and that concludes our oral argument.